catching my back, and I couldn't move. I did go down and get an adjustment on it this morning. I feel a lot better, thank you. I'm Ray Blackman. I'm an alcoholic. This is a portion of the fifth chapter entitled How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunate. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our story is disclosed in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And some of these we bought. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God, and may you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when they do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would heal us all.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Ray. We especially are welcome members of the clergy to visit with us. We need all the friends we can get. And we're so happy to have a member of the clergy with us tonight, June's pastor and his wife. And we're so happy to have you with us tonight. And also, I can't call each one by name, but June's friends and people from Lumpkin up there. You see all those goodies back there. Let me tell you, those gals, they can really fix up something to eat. I tell you, they're just out of this world. And it's so good to have all of you with us. Next, we're going to have the 12 traditions. And I'm going to ask Don J. to come up and read the 12th edition.
Well, I'm like Ray now. It's a big honor for me to be up here to help those you celebrate this thing. And I'm Don Jones, I'm an alcoholic. This is 12th edition. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Least problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name will never be drawn into public controversy. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality. I got one little thing I got to tell on old June. Well, we were down in Panama City last year, at the roundup. That old man that was doing the thing there, he said, well, everybody that just started in AA, sign up. Of course, nearly everybody stood up. Everybody except Alan on. And then he said, 1 year. Well, after he said 1 year, that cut a heap of them out. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And I hung in there a while. And pretty good. And old June was right behind me. I kept a following. He was eye on the back there. And kept on going, well enough. That old June was hanging with it. I thought sure we were going to win the prize. I said, June, hang in there a little longer. Finally, she had to sit down. Some old joker sits back there. I don't reckon that man was lying, supposed to be honest. But then he had 35 or 36 years. I thought, my God, he ought to have been undied so June could win the prize. Happy birthday. We
come in pretty early, though. You know, I forget a lot of things. I'm not going to tell you. I'm nervous. So. I know what it is. It's that snow we had last Sunday morning. I went out to light church heaters and turn on the furnace, and I went and got me a box of matches. Went and got in the car, and I sit there, and I struck the match and stuck it to the switch key. Alcohol didn't kill them kind of brain cells. I don't think it's that snow. I'm going to get the announcements out of the way right now. If I have any announcements.
You've all had the meeting next Wednesday night in an Al-Anon meeting, and on the latest from Albany is on top of it.
Anyone else?
Yes, we're at the Northside group. We're going to have a lady from Coastal to come talk for us Saturday night. June will retire from us. We love to have you. The Northside Group meets at the corner of Clancy and 2nd Avenue at the Lutheran Church.
Any other announcements? So you want to have something to say? Well, let's do it now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello. I'm Patty Pearson, a non-alcoholic and a lover of alcoholics. I've always said that God must have a little place in his heart that's a little different from all the rest of us, because he gave you all the talent, the brains, the personality, the humor, you name it. He gave it to you, good people. I just wanted to tell you one thing. In reminiscing, I look back over 20 years ago, and June and her husband bought the hotel. It was a big old house. It had been my great-grandfather's home, and he left it to a daughter, and they made a hotel out of it. About 3:30 one morning, it was cold. The phone rang, and June says, "Come on over. Wake me up out of a dead sleep." She and Mabel always said I didn't have sense enough to know when anybody was drunk. But anyway, I got up, went on over, and she turned on the organ, and she got on the organ, and I got on the piano. And we started playing, just like it was 7 o'clock at night. I never gave an inch or a second. In about 2 weeks, she called, and she says, "I'm packing." I said, "Where are you going?" She says, "I'm going to Bronner's." And I went over there and saw her pack that bag. But she came back quicker than she got up there. And I tell you, in Lumpkin, Georgia, you heard the song, "It's June and January." Well, in Lumpkin, it's June and January and every month in the year because of Abba June, and I love her. I love her soul.
Yeah, you know, June, she is, was here when I come to this group. All the women sit here and all the men over here, and I walked in there, and of course Ruth pointed around and says, it's him, talking about me. And she sat over there, and I sat over here. After the little bit, I asked Ted, I said, "Look at him." I said, that lady sitting there, I said, "Which one is her husband?" He says, "She's an alcoholic." I said, "Oh my God, what's this world coming to now?" But we love her. She's sort of been the mama in this group. I tell you, we have to keep her straight a lot of times. Happy birthday, June. This time I'm going to ask June, if she will, to come up and introduce our speaker. And may I say this, Ted used to say, when I'd tell him I didn't get nothing out of the meeting, he'd say, "Well, did you bring anything to put it in?" And cut me down. Well, I'm going to tell you now, after this meeting tonight, you can walk out that door and say, "My cup running over." June, come on up and introduce.
I'm June Duke, and I'm an alcoholic, and I work with my family. Our speaker tonight, I love. I first remember Jody when he buried my sponsor. And that was a very sad occasion. And then he was here, I believe, last year. Well, I've been seeing him off and on at the Methodist conferences, but I just would speak to him. I didn't talk this talk much. And then he talked down here last year, and I remember telling Jody, "I want you to talk at my birthday next year." And he said, "All right, let me know." Well, a few weeks ago, I called him, and he very graciously said, "I'll be there unless you hear from me." And I began to get a little bit worried because I didn't write to him. I should have written him back up my phone call, but I didn't. And but he called me this morning. And this voice at the other end of the phone we didn't recognize and said, happy birthday. And I said, well, thank you. He said, this is Jody. And I thought, oh, Jody's not coming. But when I did ask him, I asked him if he would be in this vicinity. I wouldn't ask Jody to come all the way from Metal, Georgia, to Cuthbert to talk at my birthday. Now, I really wouldn't. And Carl asked me the other night, I said, you didn't ask him to come that far to come over here, did you? I said, no, he told me he would be in Pinehurst on the 9th. And so I thought he would be in this vicinity. But I didn't insist that he stay home this morning when Carl. I was glad to know he was coming. And we do have a treatment store. I kind of drew back when you mentioned that my preacher was here because I thought, uh-oh, Jody's not going to tell us what it's like, man. But he's pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty understanding. But you know, talking about ministers, I've always loved my ministers. I was raised to love one of them. I was raised to love them whether I loved them or not. And before I did take up the career of drinking, I loved them. And then after I got sober, I just loved them to death. But during that period of drinking, I worried the devil out of our Baptist preacher. Never did call my Methodist minister. Anyway, I gave that Baptist preacher trouble. But I'm going to tell this little joke and then I'll turn it over to you. But this sponsor was having, you might have heard it, trouble with his alcoholic when he first came into AA. He was having, the alcoholic was having a problem with the spiritual side of this, which of course we all have a little problem in the beginning and all along maybe with the spiritual end of it. And so he told his pigeon to go to church. He said, why don't you try going to church one Sunday? So he did and he liked it. And he went up to the preacher and shook his hand. He said, that was a damn good sermon. And the preacher said, well, thank you, but let's watch your language. He said, well, it was such a damn good sermon, I had to put $100 in the plate. And the preacher says, to hell you say. I think Jody might have had some problems like that.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jody, and I'm an alcoholic. The only fear I have is the fear that one day I may reach and pick up that first drink again. That causes fear because I know it would mean instant insanity and certain death. That's just something I threw in Courtney for your benefit. He says I say the same thing every time, so I thought I'd say a little something different for Courtney's benefit. It is good to be here, and I think if this had been June's 19th birthday, I probably would have called a Saturday and counseled out because I too was down in the back. Seems to go along with the aging process. But thanks to my doctor, when he got there, I said, have you ever heard of June Duke? He said the name's familiar. He practiced medicine not too far from your parts at one time. And I said, well, you've got to get me in shape to be in Cuthbert for her 20th birthday on Monday night. And I am thrilled and happy to be here because I realize the fact that the longer we're in this fellowship, the more we need it. They taught me when I first came in that the farther you are from your last drink, the closer you are to your next. That being the case, buddy, we're getting pretty close. So it takes a lot of meetings for me. And I'm here tonight with the hope and the prayer that I'll be able to make it one more 24-hour period. And I hope also that I might be able to say something that may help somebody in this room tonight to make one more 24-hour period without alcohol. My anonymity has already been broken, the fact that I'm a Methodist minister and have been for a number of years. Over in the town where I live now at Meta, I'm not the pastor of the First Methodist Church. I was at one time, for a period of 5 years, pastor of the First Methodist Church there. And in the town, we have a local packing shop called T.T.'s Packing Shop. One day I was in the parsonage, just sort of, well, goofing off, I guess, and the telephone rang. And I answered the telephone with just my usual hello. And this feminine voice on the other end said, T.T., would you please send 2 fists of scotch around to the house before dark? And I recognized this lady's voice. It'd be one of my good Methodist ladies. One of my good Bible reading, Sunday school teaching, praying souls. And I thought it'd be a good time to sort of put her in a place. So I said, this is not T.T., this is your pastor. I thought she'd come back and apologize, but instead she came back and said, what in the hell are you doing in T.T.'s packing shop? A friend of mine said the other day he considered himself a social drinker for 30 years, and I said, well, I considered myself a social drinker, you know, as long as I was good. I thought it was social. Until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and found out what alcoholism is. But looking back and taking my inventory after coming into fellowship, I realized I was in trouble from the beginning. The first week, all I had of any serious trouble was alcohol. Waking up in jail at Jacksonville Beach at the age of 16, not knowing why I was there, what I'd been guilty of. They later told me that they had locked me up the night before because I had been throwing beer bottles at the bartender. I didn't think too much of it, really. That's what we refer to in AA as unusual behavior. I was having it from the beginning. Also, not being able to remember what had happened. I know now that I was in a blackout. I did not know that at the time. I doubt seriously would that have stopped me if I had known what it was. I continued to drink through college. I went to college back during the days of the Depression on a football scholarship. And during my junior year, I was kicked out of school. And they didn't call us alcoholics back then. They sent a letter home to my parents, said, we're sending your son home because he is an habitual drunkard. This was at the age of 19 and should have said something to me. But the following fall, I got a telegram from the football coach, come on back to school. He made arrangements to get me back in. And I went back and they carried me in the president's office and I had to take the vows and the pledge, you know. You know, I will not drink, you know, and I'll do this, and I'll behave, and so forth and so on. As soon as I walked out of the president's office, I said to myself, well, I knew they couldn't get along without me. You know, if they go win in the ball games, I am a necessity. Well, how are you going to stay sober with an attitude like that? And I didn't. I went right on doing the same old thing over and over. Drinking anything and everything that I could get my hands on that anybody would tell me would make me feel a little better. And in 1940, I left college and went over to South Carolina and went to work on the railroad. And immediately I began to make more money than I ever dreamed existed. I remember my first payday, I carried down my check down to the bank and got it all in $1 bills. Carried home, put it on the bed, you know, and just kind of shuffled it around and looked at it. The depression was over, as far as I was concerned. I thought, well, you know, I'll work for these folks up here a year or two, and then I'll just buy this railroad. But, of course, you know what happened. My alcoholism progressed. And I soon discovered that I could work about half the time and stay drunk about half the time. And still have plenty of money in my pocket. And that was the way I was living for a while until World War II came on. When the war came on, I went down and volunteered, although I had occupational deferment and could have stayed at home. I went in not because of any patriotism or courage, But I went into the service with the hope and the prayer that I'd be killed. This would put an end to the mess that I had made out of my life. I had lost the desire to live. This was what alcohol had done to me at the age of 23. But after getting in the service, I got a little better. We couldn't drink except on the weekends, and I got a little better physically and mentally. And I used to say I didn't get any better spiritually at this point, but continuing to take my inventory over a period of years, I realized that maybe I did make some spiritual progress at that point because the desire to live came back. I no longer wanted to die, I wanted to live. And I think that this is spiritual in nature. A desire to live. A desire to be a part of God's world. Well, I started corresponding with a girl I had courted in college, and we were married while I was still in pre-flight school. Probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I thought seriously about it in recent years. I doubt without her influence and guidance and help and understanding that I would ever have had a desire to stop drinking. I probably would have died drunk. I remember on our wedding day, I thought, well, now I'm going to quit drinking. I've been drinking because I was lonely, and I'll have companionship. I won't need to drink. But I soon discovered that matrimony is not a cure for alcoholism. And I went right on doing the same thing every opportunity that I had. I managed somehow, by the grace of God, to complete the program of aviation cadets. Graduated with the coveted silver wings of an Air Force pilot. I remember on my graduation day, my father said to me, now that you have all this responsibility of an officer and a gentleman, don't you think it would be a good time for you to stop drinking liquor? And of course, that was the furthest thing from my mind. Now I had more free time, I had more money, and of course, you know what happened again. Alcoholism progressed. It seems there are two things that an alcoholic has a time to tolerate. That's money in his pocket and time on his hands. So he'll usually get drunk if he has those two things together. And I can stand up here all night and tell you weird things that happened to me during my flying days with Uncle Sam caused by my drinking. I can remember many times going to the flight line before daylight, still three-fourths cropped, having to walk up to the airplane and close one eye to pick out the number to find out which one was mine. See 19 young men standing beneath the wing of the plane waiting for my arrival. Me not only taking my own life, but the lives of others in my hand while under the influence of alcohol. And I didn't think anything of it. I thought, well, everybody's doing it, you know. We were living under that philosophy, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. We were doing it. We were eating and drinking and being merry most of the time. But I realized after I got in Alcoholics Anonymous that that kind of behavior was insane behavior. So I did not have too much argument, some, but not too much, with the second step, the insanity part, because I realized as I took my inventory that I had done many insane things under the influence of alcohol. After getting out of the service, I went back to the railroad and went to work. Our first son was born shortly after my discharge, and I remember thinking, well, I'm going to turn over a new leaf. I'm going to quit drinking liquor. I'm going to work and be somebody. And for a while, I worked at it. And I think the company that I worked for recognized possibly that I had matured a little while in the service. And they began to talk about making me an official on the railroad. And I heard this rumor, and I think it bolstered up my alcoholic ego enough to keep me sober for a while. But when the job that they had rumored for me went to somebody else, you know what happened? I got drunk at them. That was the only defense I had. The only recourse I had was to get drunk. Now, I still have a time facing disappointments, heartaches, grief. You know, when you see your hopes and dreams and all go down the tube, it's pretty hard to take. The only difference between now and then is that now I do not have to drink when these things happen to me. I have a program to live by. God knows I have to lean on it every day. But at that particular time, that was the only recourse I had, was to drink liquor. And from that point in 1946 till I found this fellowship in 1952, things were pretty rough for me. I managed to hold on to my job, keep my family together. God blessed our home with another son and then a daughter. Looking back, it seems to me that every time my family responsibilities increased, my alcoholism progressed. I know now, I did not know then, that I was using alcohol as a means of escape from the harsh reality of day-to-day nitty-gritty making a living for family. I went through all of the stages of alcoholism in its final form, the DTs, hallucinations, loss of time from work, all of these things, being called in on the carpet and threatened, all of this, but nothing seemed to help at all. The first contact I had with Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1951. A friend of mine at America's Georgia, who worked with the same railroad company I did, I went down and visited him during the Christmas holidays and visited my family who lived there. And I went into his house that night with a gallon jug hooked over my finger. And I had been in it, you know, all day, in and out of it. It was in pretty good shape. But when I got in his house, I offered him a drink. He said, "No, thank you." I thought, well, something's happened here. He loved booze more than I did, I thought. And he got out a little white chip. Started telling me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "Yeah, I know all about that thing. I said, I read about it in a Saturday Evening Post." And I said to him, "I sure am glad that they have finally found something for you poor old drunks that don't know how to handle your liquor." And so we went on talking, and I kept pouring one every now and then, getting louder and more arrogant, I'm sure, all the time. And after a while, he brought out some of the AA literature he had picked up and said, "Maybe you ought to take this with you and read it. Might do you some good." I said, "Oh, they won't let me in there." I said, "I'm not an alcoholic." Now get this picture. Here he's sitting there sober and I'm drunk, and I'm telling him why he's an alcoholic and I'm not. And I said things to him like, "Well, you know, the company fired you twice about your drinking. They never have fired me." And I said, "You know, your wife quit you two or three times." I said, "Catherine never had left me. Therefore, you're an alcoholic, I'm not." And I said, "You live here in this little old apartment?" And I said, "Over in Carolina." I said, "Man, I own my own home and pay my taxes, stay out of jail part of the time." Well, what I'm saying is that at that point, I could not possibly identify myself as an alcoholic. God knows I wish I could have. Because I would have saved myself thousands of dollars and untold suffering if I had accepted what he was offering me at that point. But instead, I said, no, I don't need it. The 1st of January, 1952, I said, well, I'm going to show them I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just going to quit drinking less. Not go to all those meetings and associate with all those drunks. I just quit. And I did. And I was mean enough to do it. And I shook. And I stayed depressed. And I worked. I worked. And for 5 months and 6 days, I was sober or dry. But I was the most miserable creature on the face of God's earth. And I did not know what was wrong with me. I think now I know. I think during that period, that deep down under, I knew that somewhere out yonder, in some tomorrow, that I was going to pick that drink up again. And I was filled with fear because I did not know whether I could survive another drunk or not. The last one I had been on back there in December had almost killed me. And a lot of weird, strange things happened to me. Little things, you know, like being picked up for indecent exposure. That's going down the street without your clothes on. This social drinking was getting to me. I don't know how much more sociable you could be than that. Really. But on the 6th day of June, I went on a fishing trip with some railroad cronies, drinking buddies, and I knew they were going to have liquor everywhere, but I'm just going along and fish and have fun. I'm not going to drink any. And all day long, I said, no, thank you. They had the big bottles, the little ones, the round ones, the square ones, and all kinds. Along late in the evening, we were cleaning some fish, fixing to have a big fish fry. And man, they were all feeling good. I mean, feeling good. You know, singing and telling funny stories and laughing. I was tired, hot, mad, and thirsty. And finally, a friend of mine had a gallon jug of that old North Georgia Applejack that I loved dearly. And I said, Ed, I believe I'll take a drink out of your jug. And he said, Vance, if I've been sober long as you, I don't believe I'd ever touch another drop. I said, oh, one won't hurt. And I don't know why I said that, because I never had been interested in one drink. If one was all I could have, I didn't want it. But I took one, and then another, and another. And they were all out there, you know, in this big room. I was back there cooking the fish. I'm about the only one sober enough to cook. They were all out there playing that five-card game, you know, that soldiers and railroad men like to indulge in, you know, peeping at the whole cards. And I was in a hurry to get out there because I was addicted to that, too. And but while they were doing that, and I was cooking, I was pouring the one out of their bottle, you know. I don't remember leaving the place. This was the beginning of a drunk that I like to think of as being a necessary drunk. Now, some of you may not understand that terminology, necessary drunk. You may say, no such thing as a necessary drunk. But all drunks are very unnecessary. But it was necessary in this respect to teach me that I'm an alcoholic and that my life was a man. I did not believe this before. I really didn't. And so for a period of about 6 weeks, I put myself through a living hell. During the month of June, I continued to work, drinking on the job and off, saying to myself, well, if I can just make it till the 1st day of July, I got a vacation coming up in 2 weeks, I'll taper off and everything will be fine. You don't have to keep telling yourself that. Everything's going to be all right. Though she couldn't endure it. But I kept struggling. I'd have them call me an hour earlier than usual. They'd call me in the middle of the night so I could take two or three drinks so I could get my hands steady enough where I could shave, you know, before I went to work. Then I'd have to take another one before I got to the office so I could sign my name. I'd run that engine down the road to Atlanta. Before I got to Atlanta, I'd have to have another drink or two so I could sign off down there, make out a little work report. Well, this is sick. Other members of the crew would go in to eat. I'd say, no, y'all go and eat it. I'm not hungry. I'd go up the street somewhere looking for a pint of wine. Something to try to keep me from dying until I could get back home. I made it till the 1st of July and took the vacation. I said to my wife the day we left, I said, you get the children ready, I'm going down to get the car service. And I stepped down at the liquor store to get me a little tapering off medicine. I was going to taper off while I was on vacation. And I bought a case of half pints to taper off on. And I hid them under my seat in the trunk of my car because I didn't want Catherine to know I'd started back drinking. Of course, I'd been drunk, you see, for, you know, about 3 weeks then, but I didn't think she knew it because she was not harassing me about it. Well, on that vacation, these half pints lasted just a few days because I was popping like peanuts. And after they were gone, I started driving from the little cabin where I was staying on the Flint River to America's, to the Bootleggers. Go in there, and I'd get me a pint, or a half a pint. Saying to myself, now when this is gone, we're going to quit. Oftentimes, before I'd get back to the river, I'd drink that and turn around and go back and get another. And it was back and forth, back and forth. And a lot of bad things were happening to me then. I remember one time waking up out in the yard, you know, sun shining in my face. I just dropped out there during the night. I thought for a while my wife had given up on me. She said, no, I hadn't given up on you. She said, I just couldn't pick you up. One day I was in America's and get a pain, and I'd had a few. I got to thinking about my mother who lived right on the main street there in America. She had close neighbors all around. And I thought, well, I'll go out and see her. She had taught me since I had been big enough to walk about the evils of alcohol and about the sinfulness of drinking liquor. And she had said to me as a child, I would rather see you dead than drunk. I thought, well, I'll go out and see her anyway. I stopped my car in front of her house. Got out to go in. I had on some old flying fatigues and hadn't bathed in days or shaved. And beards wasn't cute then, you know. And I started up the walkway and I fell drunk in her front yard. And I couldn't get up. I tried to get up, my knees would collapse. I could drive good, but I couldn't walk. And finally, she had to come out and pick her baby up and take me into the house. And when she got me in there, this is what she said. She said, what in the world will the neighbors think? And I let it be known in the voice that the neighbors could hear in the next block what the neighbors could do and where they could go. But I point that out to you to bring out something that I think is very important. That oftentimes, the families of alcoholics are more concerned about what the neighbors are going to think than they are about the sick and suffering and dying alcoholic. If you don't believe that, you make a few 12-step calls and you'll find that it's true. I remember making one not too many years ago. A lady called me and said her husband was in bed, wanted to come around there. So it happened that a doctor friend of mine from Alabama, a heart specialist, was visiting with me at that time. And he went with me. And we got in there, and he, you know, checked the fellow's blood pressure, pumped him up, and left him, looked, and most of me step out in the hall. So we got to get him in the hospital. immediately said he's dying. Said his blood pressure is, you know, 200 and something, all over something. And I could tell it was kind of an emergency. So I rushed out into the den and talked to the family. His wife and his sons and daughters-in-laws and all had gathered out there in the den, you know. They holding one of these little meetings on him, you know. You know how they hold these meetings on him to get in that shape. They talk about things like, what we're going to do with him this time. where we're going to send him this time, you know. And I said to the family, I said, the doctor said we got to get him out to the hospital immediately. He's dying. And they said, oh, we can't do that. Oh, I said, you know, his brother's on the board out there. And said, the doctor put it on his record, you know, alcoholism, and said, everybody in town knows. Well, back off and think about that for a while. What they were actually saying, they were saying, let the SOB die, but don't dare tell the neighbors. And this is not because of any lack of love for our family's part. It's a lack of understanding of this disease that we call alcoholism. And I don't know why we ought to expect our families to understand it when those of us who had it don't understand it. You heard it read here a moment ago. As cunning, baffling, and powerful as it is, doctors can't diagnose it. They can treat it, but they can't diagnose it. It's strange. Well, anyway, after that so-called vacation, I went on back to work. Worse shape than I had left in. The tapering off method didn't work too good for me. Have you ever tried to drink yourself sober? It's a pretty interesting thing. Well, that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to drink myself sober.